Hi, this is Daniel Garber, the movies for CulturalMining.com and CIUT 89.5 FM. Aladdin had his magic lamp, King Arthur his Excalibur. What do we have to define ourselves? What talismans can protect us against outside forces? And how do we record our histories? Can our lives be summed up as a list of likes on a Facebook page? Well, one man in the UK discovered his lost history and possibly the meaning of life in a most unusual place. A dusty plastic VHS tape at his late grandfather's house. It was viewed, reviewed, and pondered to contain the fears, memories, and nightmares of his childhood as seen on broadcast TV. Stand By for Tape Backup is the title of a new autobiographical documentary having its world premiere at Hot Docs, Toronto's International Documentary Film Festival. But it's not like any conventional documentary you've ever seen. It consists entirely of VHS footage and clips of movies and TV shows, from Michael Jackson music videos to clips from Ghostbusters and Fresh Prince of Bel Air, played again and again, with the unseen filmmaker's voice narrating over the top. Rewinds, pauses, fast forwards, and mutes guide the viewer to new heights of psychedelic rapture and depths of abject confusion. It's hilarious, haunting, terrifying, profound, poetic, and extremely whack. And I'm very pleased to have its creator, Ross Sutherland, here with me at Hot Docs to try to make sense of Stand By for Tape Backup. Hi, Ross.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. So before we begin, though, I just want to say I took your film completely at face value, pretty much, allowing for artistic license and expression. But let me know before we begin, is this the genuine thing it says it is, or are you taking the piss?
Oh, right, okay, yes. I think I understand why it feels like it might be. I think it's one of those things. It's funny, I think people often think in the moment they believe it, and then they come out, and then they're like, "Is that all lies?" But no, I mean it's a true story. I've got I had a very, very sort of strong relationship with my granddad. You know, as I was kind of growing up, he was a very influential figure in my life. We made this kind of videotape together, kind of throughout my childhood. I mean, I did kind of rediscover it sort of several years ago. And so the backstory to the tape is true. I love the discipline of trying to kind of create an entire show just based on this kind of one plastic box. There's something which was really nice and simple about the idea of just like allowing all of that, you know, to be trapped with whatever content was on that videotape. And it's just surprising. I think if you stare at something long enough, then you can just begin to project anything onto it, I think, which is one of the nice methods of what happens in the film, of being able to rewind and replay that same piece of footage over and over and over again. And very, very, very quickly, you stop really seeing it as, you know, the opening credits of The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, and it just becomes this weird tapestry of symbols. And once it's been removed of that original context, I think you're then free to just start changing the context of what those symbols mean completely. And so, I mean, I was as shocked as anyone to get to find as many true stories as I did, kind of like hidden within that tape. I mean, it was a slow process. It took a long, long time to coax out those little details. I usually wrote about a minute per day on a good day. But I think that's the thing, is that what you're seeing on the screen in 1 hour is this compression of like a huge amount of time, about 3 years of kind of writing, which kind of comes down, which is why I think it feels kind of like slightly hyperreal. I won't say surreal, I'd say like hyperreal. It's like it feels like almost too good to be true.
Was there a moment of epiphany when it all came together, or was it just sort of germinate in the back of your mind and gradually develop?
I think I don't like. Yeah, there was certainly like breakthrough moments where suddenly pieces kind of fell into place. One of the things about using this kind of technique, and I'm because my background is from writing poetry, and I'm a huge fan of poetic form, of kind of being narrowed into a very, very specific set of kind of, you know, whether it's, I mean, a traditional form like a sonnet or a kind of like a modern form. I really love writing this style of poetry known as a univocalism, which is a poem that only contains one vowel. You just set yourself this very, very sort of tight structure, and then you're working on it for quite a while, and before you suddenly, you know, that form, it begins to kind of consume you. And then I've been working on a show for quite a while, when suddenly I was like, oh, actually, this process, it's not just something that I've been doing during the show, but you start to notice it in other areas of your life as well, where you're like, lots of the film's about repetition and about this way that we use repetition in order to cope with anxiety in our life, by being able to kind of constantly review an event over and over again. We can learn out why it scares us, and we can kind of remove the fear from that. And then I remembered that back when I was 5 years old, that my grandfather had taken me to see Ghostbusters like 5 days in a row when I was only like 4 years old.
Saw it 5 days in a row. Right then.
Right then. It was like, yeah. it was like Monday, Ghostbusters, Tuesday, Ghostbusters. And that was like one of my first experiences of going to the cinema when I was like 4 years old. So that all of a sudden you start to go, this is not just this project I'm working on now. This has been this sort of central sort of philosophy I've actually like been doing in various ways my entire life. Now that may well turn out to be Stockholm Syndrome. And just the idea of like, I've just been, you know, like deeping so deep in a project that you just start to see, it's like seeing the number 23 everywhere. There was certainly, yeah. So I think the way that the autobiography kind of came back to me was surprising. And within every single one of those kind of clips, yeah, there will have been like a eureka moment when suddenly you've learnt that clip so well, you know it shot by shot, that you can just start to kind of, it starts to become a mirror, you know.
Well, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air is a 90s sitcom starring Will Smith as a poor kid in Philly who's sent to live with his rich relatives in Los Angeles. It's making a big comeback in Canada, at least. And what you did with that movie, especially the theme songs, when you repeat it over and over, especially the spinning, turning, spinning around, that totally freaked me. Maybe that was the intended effect, but what is it, and what have you done to poor Fresh West?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think I show the opening credits of The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air 7 times. Like something like that.
I thought it was maybe 100 times.
Yeah, it does feel like that, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's implanted in my synapses. I can't get rid of it now.
I mean, I like that bit of footage because, for me personally, it was, when I was reviewing the videotape, that 30 seconds of film really stood out to me, only because I think it's possibly, of all the contents of a tape, it was the stuff that I think was the most well known, because, you know, it's a syndicated TV program, you know, like even like a famous scene in a film, we might love that scene in the film, like the end of Casablanca. Okay, it's a really well known piece of footage, but how many times have you actually like watched that scene? Only like a couple of times, right? And then you've seen parodies of it and other stuff, but like that opening credits, particularly because it's got the song that everybody knows as well, it's got a very familiar opening tune, that I think if you were to go up to, like, you know, 50 people on the street and hand them a camcorder, like, I don't know, maybe like a quarter of them, you said to them, go away and reshoot for me the opening credits of The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, I think, you know, a portion of them would be able to do it shot for shot, because, you know, like you can just see, you know, like it's him on the throne and he's turning around and it's him, he sprays the aerosol in his face, he draws the graffiti on the wall, policeman taps him on the shoulder, and then so on and so on. It's just like, I don't know, it's like it's kind of just like coded into us. And so that's what I think, what made that so interesting, is that like very, very quickly you can't see it anymore. You watch that so many times, and then it becomes this kind of cultural wallpaper. It just fades into the background, and then the stage is set for you to start messing with it over the top. But it's hypnotic.
But this is almost like a Paul is Dead moment.
Yeah. Oh well, I'm a big you know, I think that idea of, you know, now you can't really watch The Fresh Prince. If you've seen the film, it's really hard to go back and watch The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air without thinking about all this extra stuff that we've crammed into the symbolism of it. But, you know, like, I love that. I think it's interesting. And, you know, so much of this kind of video footage, it's kind of lowest common denominator. Like, if you were going to be cruel about it, you'd say, you know, like, it's pop culture. It's kind of disposable. But these are all kind of weird, kind of like, it's a shared language that we all have, that we all kind of know these things. Something that kind of like, when I used to teach poetry in school, it becomes really difficult trying to teach kind of like poetry, like modernism, to modern kind of school kids. Because, like, when the modernists were writing their poetry, they kind of, you know, like, everyone would have read the Bible, everyone would have read the classics. We don't have that shared language anymore. Those kind of things are kind of lost from us. This whole kind of resource of kind of shared stories, that's kind of gone now. So you kind of show like a modernist poem to a school kid, you've got to then go, oh, and also I've got to tell you this story, and I have to tell you that story, and I have to tell you this story. All this extra kind of baggage then kind of comes in. And so it's really, really fun to be able to take what currently consists in the kind of like in the modern canon of kind of shared stories, and it's just pop culture. It's kind of
music,
you know,
videos.
It's music video. Yeah. It's you know, like it's those kind of things. But you can kind of take that shared language, you know, like, and then you can do interesting stuff with it, and you can kind of mess with it, yeah, and kind of add extra stuff into it. One of the inspirations for the film was the experiment which I first saw when I was a university student, which is the taking The Wizard of Oz and playing Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon at exactly the same time, and then noticing all the kind of the uncanny synchronicity that happens in between. And I was like, we know they're not real, it doesn't exist, but it's very seductive when you kind of see it in action, and it means you end up treating both of those art forms differently. You watch the film slightly differently, you hear the album slightly differently. It's this kind of new way of kind of like enjoying both of them, and that's kind of partly based on just this, you know, this weird paranoiac kind of thing that your brain's doing. It's just kind of constantly creating connections between, you know, between these kind of things in your head.
And once they're in your head,
oh, you're stuck with them. Yeah.
I think that's what happened to me watching that movie. It's a brilliant movie. Thanks so much for talking with me about it.
Oh no, my pleasure.
I've been speaking with Ross Sutherland, whose new documentary, Stand By for Tape Backup, had its world premiere at Toronto's Hot Docs Documentary Film Festival. Go to hotdocs.ca for times. This is Daniel Garber, The Movies, for CIUT 89.5 FM, and on my website, culturalmining.com.